the Healthcare Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee. I know that I've lost some members, but we are already 15 minutes behind, so I'm going to start. So let's start with the update on All Payer All Claims Database. Gretchen Morley.
Good morning. For the record, excuse me. My name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the Director of Health Analytics for the Oregon Health Authority. I'll give a very brief update and see what questions you might have. I have also a two-pager that can be passed out to members on just a basic overview of the all-payer and what it is. Very briefly, it was authorized in House Bill 2009, instructing the state to start to begin to collect claims data for all carriers in the state, providing coverage to people to 5,000 lives or more, as well as pharmacy benefit managers, Medicaid managed care organizations. It includes Medicaid fee-for-service. It includes Medicare managed care. It does not, at this point, include Medicare fee-for-service. In terms of current status, we now have over 2.5 years of data loaded into the system, starting in January 2010 through June of 2012, from 40 carriers in the state. So at this point, I think any state that's undertaken an all-payer, they know it's a long-term project. We have accomplished a lot. We have a lot to go. We have done rulemaking processes. We've worked through the specifications on limited data sets for researchers, public use data sets. We've done way back in the beginning to the procurement process. We have Milliman on contract as our contractor to collect all of the all-payer data. We've been working on staff training. And then the one thing that's taken a lot of our time is the focus we have on privacy and security. And we have a privacy and security group that is up and running at this point, is finalizing documents that will govern their work. And they will be the group that's looking at researcher data requests in terms of approving those and ensuring that the privacy of the claims data and the folks that claims data is attached to is protected. We've been very cautious in this area, and there are very few staff that have direct access to personal health information. It's all going directly to Milliman, we continue to just have that as a high priority, which in some respects does slow us down a little bit, but it is worth it given the responsibility we've taken on. On the horizon, we have quite a bit planned. We have an analytic team assembled now to begin pulling data from the all-payer while we continue to do data validation and fixing things that we see that are just don't make sense when you look at the data. The carriers, the data coming in from the carriers requires work in terms of edit checks and ensuring that everything is consistent in the database, and that will be ongoing work. We have a goal of developing some regular public reporting on healthcare expenditures, utilization, geographic variation. There's a number of states that have put out some websites recently that we're looking at to learn from their experience what they're putting up and making transparent to the public. There's a lot of application of this data to the CCOs and the community level planning that we're working with folks internally and externally to the health authority to plan that. And there's a lot of public health potential in this data and working with public health analysts on that, as well as working with the Cover Oregon folks in terms of making the best use at the state level of this massive amount of data that's been collected. And we're also then going to be working going forward in terms of getting carrier input, having a forum of some kind, and we're working on exactly what that would be in terms of keeping. We've been working so much at the technical level, sort of getting the policy level folks involved in terms of how we're using the data, input from them in terms of usage. And then also just ongoing improvement of the data. Like I said, we don't have Medicare fee-for-service at this point. And we also don't have race and ethnicity data for the private carriers, and we do not. And that's a considerable undertaking, but something that we've put a lot of priority on. So let me just stop there just to see where you would like to take questions.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I appreciate you coming forward. I apologize that I missed. Okay. I got wrong information about which room we were in. Can you, for those of us who weren't on the healthcare committees when this passed, mm-hmm. can you tell me a little bit of your impression of the legislative intent and the purpose of the database?
In Council Bill 2009, there's a list of probably 8 or 10 broad descriptions of the use of the data. What I like to say is that it is up until the creation of the All-Payer, we did not have a source for broad statewide health planning, and this is a very important step in terms of being able to provide the complete look, or as complete as we possibly can get, at cost, utilization, demographic variation across the state, in order to inform consumers and policymakers, people who run programs such as Dr. Goldberg. There's quite a bit that we can mine from this data. We, at this point, one of the things I was just running through is that we're at the beginning stages of pulling out sort of the statewide data, and while there's a lot of levels, we have quite a bit of work to do to get down through the levels of mining the data and working with constituents and everybody on how you present that data to improve transparency and that kind of thing. So I'm sorry, did that answer your question?
Okay, follow up? So one thing that I was wondering is, how can just an everyday person use this, and can they have access to this data, or is there some barrier that's set up that if an individual wanted to get access to this data, how could they do so, and how could they use it?
In a couple of ways, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields. In terms of right now, the availability of the data is based on a public use data set that has been created, as well as then researcher data sets. Even at that level, that is, it requires a sophisticated individual in terms of analytic background capability, because this is claims level data. The goal is for us to be working with our partners. We have the Oregon Quality Corporation on contract in terms of helping us move toward being able to present this data in a way that is consumer friendly, and so it's not really a barrier at this point, in the sense that it's more time and work that needs to be done in order to take the claims level data and do the splicing and dicing and presentation that makes it useful to say the Oregon consumer out there.
And so if the public. So for the public set, can anybody just say, I'd like access to this data, and jump on the computer, and even if you feel like they have a difficult time using it, can anybody use this for any particular reason?
I think just sort of break that into two pieces. One, one thing I had mentioned was the Privacy and Security Committee is up and running at this point and working out final processes, and so the data set is available. It's not at this point on the web freely searchable, or I think the idea is that at some point we'd be able to use a web interface that allows people to pull data out of the public use data set in a usable way. We can talk afterwards in terms of if you're interested in the talking to the staff that are working through the processes right now. But we are farther than we've ever been before in providing that access, so we can follow up separately on that, or people can call me to find out more about that. And like I said, I just to confirm that what's being released right now is at the claims level, and claims data, even in the public use data set format, is not. Something that your average person, even myself as the director of health analytics, really has experience in working with. So it's good for that to be something that's in somebody's experience set, to be able to go through the data, and then obviously we have staff that can help answer questions. So.
Well, eventually, aren't we going to be able to take a look at what types of procedures are used and the demographics, where are they being, even down to the hospital, or will we not have the hospital, it'll just be aggregate
I think our goal is to get there. Right now, we will need to start at the aggregate and move down where there are issues around provider numbers, the kind of work that needs to be done of making sure that if we're aligning payments to, say, actually a primary care health clinic is a good example, that not all carriers bill the same way for a given provider, and some of it's individual providers, some of it's the clinics, and that's sort of nuts and bolts work that needs to go on behind the scenes to do that kind of work. So at this point, we also would want to get quite a bit of input from you know, all of you and other constituents in that process. So right now we're starting at that top level down, trying to get what is sort of maybe broader policy planning data. I'm very interested, obviously, we all are, in sort of geographic variation across the state, high-cost procedures. This is the first time that we have paid claims that we can look at. There's also, that includes also cost-sharing pieces, and we have staff right now looking, working through sort of the issues between what's in one field versus another, and do you add them together? Is that consistent across the board? Do you have that just because the data doesn't come in exactly the same from all of the carriers? So there's, just to give you a flavor of the kind of work that's going on, we have a lot of interest that mirror exactly what you were just outlining, and we can continue to keep you updated on our work plan and our progress.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question I was trying to get at before, if any person wants to come on, click on "I want the public data set," can they do that, or do they have to have some credentials or qualifications or some public interest, or can they say, "I want to use this for whatever I want and I just want to go get the data"?
It is not that easy at this moment. Right now, we, like I said, we are working through the final sort of what somebody would need to give us in order to access the public use data set. So that's not 100% finalized at this point. And I can give you more background on that information or that process, or people can come and inquire with myself. And some of them, we have managers that are overseeing this as well, and we can walk them through where we are in the process at this point.
And so what are those requirements at this point? I mean, the public data set is available.
The public data set has been run by Milliman. We have it accessible for folks. At this point, we were asking people to we're working through data use agreement issues is the bottom line. So I actually cannot tell you exactly a easy process right now in terms of here's the form, sign it out. But we are working very actively with people and returning around requests and questions as fast as we possibly can. So I know it's not exactly the answer that you're looking for, but I'm happy to talk more with you too.
And then finally, Madam Chair, I would like to know, because I do think how this has been talked about is this should be accessible for the general public. Right. If it's only going to be for researchers, that's fine. I'm not sure if that was the legislative intent.
No, and we understand that, Senator Mosenis and Senator Shields. We have we are almost there, and ideally we'd be able to at some point put it on the web, like I said, in an interface that doesn't require people to actually come in and work directly with myself or my managers. We're just not quite there yet because of all the myriad of technical issues that we've been working through.
Right. And so finally, my concern is that if somebody has to come and justify, why they want to use this data, if there is, privacy issues, I think that's one thing. If it's the person just wants to use it for their own interests and you don't have a real statutory or rule reason to deny them, I would be concerned about that. But finally, also, has there been any discussion about trying to use this in the health insurance rate review process at all?
Yes, we've had conversations, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields, with both the DCBS and Cover Oregon in terms of how they can be making use of this data and really not duplicate data collection efforts, that kind of thing. As you can imagine, the devil's always in the detail as to whether or not the exact the needed fields are all collected, that kind of conversation. But we are pursuing making the most out of this collection for state policymaking and insurance work.
All right. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll had a presentation from Mike Maley, Sarah Jane Owens, and Leslie Sutton on developmental disabilities program sustainability. And just so that the public knows, the presentation on curriculum and training standards for performing clinical breast exams task force is off the calendar. Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Maley. I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Developmental Disability Services within the Department of Human Services. And I wanted to start off by thanking you for the chance just to give an overview of our kind of long-range plan for people with developmental disabilities. And the hope is to just provide a general framework about our actions and to be informative to you in terms of what we're doing, in terms of the discussions and the deliberations and the decisions, you know, that you will be making around, you know, the developmental disabilities service system. And in terms of context, developmental disabilities are individuals with intellectual disabilities and other disabling conditions such as autism or cerebral palsy that have a significant impact on somebody's ability to function independently, their lifelong, and they manifest in childhood, you know, prior to adulthood. So that's kind of the group. And then from a historical standpoint, again, just in terms of context, in the last 15 years, there's been some major milestones in our service systems that have been accomplished. In the year 2000, we closed the Fairview State Training Center. And in 2009, closed the Eastern Oregon State Training Center. And with the closure of that, we became just one of a handful of states that have no institutional services for people with developmental disabilities. In 2011, we marked the 10-year anniversary of adult support services for people with developmental disability, and that was an innovative approach. It was spawned out of the Staley lawsuit. I think some of you may have heard about that. But again, an innovative approach with the idea of providing supports for people and resources to live in their own home, to purchase services so they could stay in their own homes and not go to more complex and expensive 24-hour types of services. And without the Staley adult support services, people would still be on wait lists or would be in services that weren't really appropriate to meet their need and be more expensive than what would be necessary. So those two accomplishments were major. And they really established Oregon, I think, in many ways as a national leader in terms of people with serving people with developmental disabilities. But where we find ourselves now is we need to really start looking ahead. Those were major accomplishments, but there's still tons of work that we need to do, and that's really where I wanted to get to at this point. You know, we need to start looking from a developmental disability system at kind of the next generation of services. At the same time, we have a high demand in terms of numbers of services. Our system is growing at a rate of something like 4% per year in terms of people seeking and being eligible for our services. We're also being told by the users of services and their families what they really want are services that are much more individualized, much more, you know, ingrained in their communities, and really have some outcomes that are really, you know, helpful for them in terms of employment and really being a part of their community. So what people are asking of us is changing over what has been kind of historical kind of discussion. And I think, as you all know, we have workforce and other economic challenges that are still going to be, you know, out there. And what that really means for us is we need to consider to looking at ways to help our system evolve that's less dependent on the higher cost, you know, out-of-home type of services that have lots of staffing demands, and start looking at alternatives to that. And that's really the linchpin of what our long-range plan is built around. So if we look kind of at the components of the plan that we've got into place, there's really six primary pieces to that. I mean, there's lots of activities around it, but it's hinged on six kind of strategic components. One is really doing a better job at providing services to people that are 18 to 26 year old. When we looked at some of our data, especially on the crisis piece where people have such a circumstance where they're in threat of losing their home and they go from place to place, you know, trying to find a spot that really is going to meet their needs. When we look at that information, about 80% of the resources used were 18 to 26-year-olds. You know, and there was just some phenomenon going on there. So what we're doing is we're looking at specific strategies through our and targeted strategies through our rules and contracts, so we can do some things that specifically address better address the needs of those individuals. So instead of ending up in long-term 24-hour types of services, after 2 to 3 years of services, they can live more independently, you know, at less cost and more successfully.
Senator,
I'm sorry.
That component, what percent of those people are hitting your system because they're aging out of foster care?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Cruz, they're not really aging out of foster care in a sense. So ours is one thing I failed to mention, we're a lifelong service. So you can have a child in foster care, and then when they turn 18, which is the age of becoming an adult, they could still stay, but it would be an adult foster care setting, so they don't age out in that sense. I think the point that I'm trying to make is there are lots of kids that age where foster care isn't the appropriate place for them, and we're trying to do
it. We're also talking about it may not be appropriate, but they have a place, and,
yes.
And then when they get out of that setting, then they have to have another place for them. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have about, I think it's around 500 kids in foster care, but that would be all age groups, so that subset would then transition to be more specific to your question.
Thank you.
Okay. A second component to the strategic thinking is really a better use of technology. You know, I'm kind of at the wrong generation to talk in any detail about that, but there's certainly a burgeoning, you know, knowledge about and use of technology that really applies to our service system. And the idea is to look at the various opportunities there so we could minimize the need for, say, paid staffing in somebody's life without compromising, you know, health and safety and independence, you know, for individuals. So whether that's something like a remote monitoring type of situation or some sort of an app for a smartphone, you know, there are examples that are being generated out there now that really do meet that goal. So we're trying to learn more about that. We put out a request for proposal a few months ago to do some training and technical assistance around this with the idea of teaching case managers and others who do planning, you know, how to start incorporating thinking about the use of technology when doing individual plans for folks, and then how to start where to find, you know, where that technology may exist. So it's kind of establishing that thought process and planning process as a core competency, you know, at that planning level. A third component to the long-range planning is around improving employment outcomes for working-age adults with developmental disabilities. And what I mean by that is really helping people get real jobs with real employers. And the fundamental linchpin there is to the degree that we can increase people's economic self-sufficiency, then as a system, how we support them, we have more flexibility in doing that as well. It's also a key value of our system, but it also has some strategy significance to where we need to go long range. I'd mentioned earlier the adult support services. It is, in fact, the largest, by just number of people served, it's the largest single segment of our service system. There are about 72 to 7,300 adults in our adult support services. But what we believe we can do is make some adjustments there where we can still use that concept of in-home support in a little broader way to prevent people who are in crisis going into the most expensive types of care. okay, and some people that are already in that care to maybe kind of step down, if you will, into a less expensive and more in-home type of arrangement. So we're looking at building and enhancing the whole adult support system piece. The fifth element is really supporting families and looking at ways to continue to do that. The reality in our system is still that 70 to 80% of the individuals with developmental disabilities are still living at home with their families. And so that's a huge caregiver role or support role, if you will. And so looking at ways to keep supporting families in that role so people can stay in their homes as long as possible. One of the approaches that we've just started in the last a little while is something called family-to-family networks, where you've really got family members talking to family members about, you know, the issues that they are addressing, the other resources that may be able to find, you know, that help families out. And that proves to be, I think, a really successful concept, you know, that we're hopeful to build on over time. And then finally, the last piece is just information technology. We have a very kind of diffuse, is not probably the right word, but very decentralized structure in developmental disabilities, because a lot of our services are through county government and through provider systems, and we don't have a lot of electronic systems that really tie key information together, so we're looking at ways to do that, so we're in a stronger position information-wise for strategic planning, you know, in the long run. And just closing, one of the things that I failed to mention a little bit earlier in terms of some of the major milestones is one of the successes there was a lot of stakeholder involvement. You know, that no one can pull this off in isolation. So whether it's advocates, self-advocates, family members, providers, there's been a lot of cooperative, collaborative work in pulling these major milestones off. And we're using that same strategy in terms of this long-range plan. We have a group of stakeholders together that's helping discuss and work our way through these longer-range issues and finding the right paths to success. And we actually have a couple of members of that group you'll hear today just to say a couple of words about that.
Thank you.
Let's see, you're going to go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Leslie Sutton. I'm the policy analyst for the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. For years, the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities and other stakeholders have been discussing sustainability of Oregon's developmental disability system. We've brought in stakeholders that include people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, their families, their providers, and many other stakeholders. We're well aware of the increased demand for services. We also have a changing demographic, which is shifting to people with more significant challenges. And we realize that there are declining resources. The council provides staff to the Sustainability and Innovation Group, which Mr. Maley just mentioned. It's a group of 25 representatives from different stakeholder groups within our developmental disabilities community. It meets monthly to discuss sustainability within our DD system here in Oregon. It's actually helped to plan many of the initiatives that Mr. Maley just walked you through. The council is also particularly involved in the family-to-family networks. And these are designed to provide families with peer support that can accomplish two things. The first is to empower families who have children with developmental disabilities, and also to facilitate a greater community engagement for those families. The families help each other by tapping into their collective strength and knowledge. And it doesn't replace the specialized services that the developmental disability system provides or case management that families may need. But it fills a large gap that currently exists because services to Oregon families has declined. The family networks are currently, there are four of them. They're currently in Bend, Portland, Medford, and Eugene. And the governor's budget proposes to expand to an additional six family-to-family networks. We're very excited about these accomplishments of these family-run groups, and we're happy to talk to you in more depth at another time. Thank you for your opportunity today.
Senator Mona Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Jane Owens. I work for the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm the Developmental Disability Specialist. So I'm going to reference a couple of points that Mike talked about. One is that as a previous Developmental Disabilities Program Manager in a county, we saw many of the 18 to 21-year-olds come through our doors. We call them the swinging doors, because many of these young individuals would come out of a service system. They wanted their own life, their own apartment, a job, a girlfriend, or a boyfriend. You know, they really wanted to own their lives, and often they were in foster care, adult foster homes, group homes, and it was a struggle for them because we have raised a generation of young people who are much more independent. And so the options that we've built in the past, while they've supported many people, don't support this young group of people. So I think one of the initiatives Michael talked about, that 18 to 26-year-old group, is really key because it does provide people a life. Hopefully it reduces costs in our service system. And money is important, and we understand that. But I think what we see and value and feel really more important is that people are participating in the community. They have a job. You know, jobs, as you know, keep people out of poverty. They pay taxes. They participate in the day-to-day activities of a community life. They vote. And so the more that we can help these young people be independent and be on their own, or some may return to their family homes and continue to live with their families. But, you know, options and choices. But we can only do that if we really expand and increase our network of services, which these initiatives talk about, kind of the sustainability of our system. You know, families play a really critical role in our system. We've talked about the family-to-family networks. For our younger children, those under the age of 18, family support programs are really critical to helping to keep young people, again, out of more expensive programs such as children's foster care. So we need to look at a prevention end, and we help support young families who have children, children who are still living at home with their families, and then children who are older and may continue to live with their families. It's not only many of our folks who are returning home, who live at home with their families, but, you know, as today, many individuals still live with their families. So supporting families is really critical in this process. Our provider system, as you know, has taken a lot of cuts. We have less staff, less funding, but we really can't provide less services to individuals to be able to keep them healthy and safe in our communities. So the innovation around the technology that we've talked about, remote monitoring, iPads, how many people have iPads today? We can take that technology and really expend it and help people live in their own apartments, go grocery shopping, cook, have people over for dinner, how to figure out how to get to their job on time. So the technology piece of this is really critical, again, to the independence. So in ending, you know, we have a lot of very exciting opportunities ahead of us, a lot of innovation that we can do to really, again, go back to helping people to be independent, have real lives in the community, have jobs, and participate. And our community developmental disability programs are really very fully in support of our innovation and our techniques to really expand our service system. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a while since we heard from you, and I thank you very much for bringing us up or updating us. Thank you. With that, Coalition for a Healthy Oregon has a 10-minute only. We're really running behind, so I'm going to be really strict on time here. So would Gail Heading and Phil Greenhill please come forward?
She's got a fine one. And it's on the desk.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gail Heading. I am the Director of CCO Development for All Care Health Plan.
And I'm Nikki Peppel with All Care Health Plan.
I really appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today, and what I'd like to do is give you some information about All Care Health Plan and what we have done to implement a CCO in the Southwest Oregon area. So we're going to bring up a a brief presentation here, and I do have copies available after the presentation if you'd like a hard copy of that. Just in the way of background, when we get the presentation up and you see the name and the logo, I want to point out that that was developed by a group of about 40 stakeholders that we convened, I think it was a year ago now. We started meeting monthly. There it is. And as part of that process of working with all those stakeholders, they did define the actual name and the logo for the organization, and we're very proud of that participation. First and foremost, we must have a vision if we want to achieve our objectives, and as you see here, it is our vision to be the premier CCO in Southwest Oregon, focusing on quality, cost-efficient health care to our members and our communities. This is our service area. We have a three-county service area, Curry, Josephine, and Jackson County. And what I have presented here is our current enrollment in those counties, and then our provider network and the breakout for primary care providers, specialists, and ancillaries. Those numbers represent about 95% of the available providers in the area. So it is a substantial network providing choice and access to members, and I'll have some comments about access in a moment. And then as you can see, there are six hospitals serving our area network. This is the list of stakeholders, and they encompass all providers and others who support the system within our three-county area, dental providers, food banks, hospitals, rural health clinics, county mental health authorities. As you can see, we do continue to meet the stakeholders at the conclusion of the certification process and the beginning of the implementation of the CCO, chose to continue to meet, and we do meet now on a basis of about every 6 to 8 weeks. So it's been a very, very advantageous method for us to promote ideas, get opinions and feedbacks from those who are impacted by the CCO in our service area. This is a graphic of how we're structured and how we applied the legislative regulations to All Care Health Plan. Obviously, at the center of our CCO is the member. We have a separate board of directors for our coordinated care organization. We also have three community advisory councils, one in each of the counties that we serve. A clinical risk advisory panel, which represents those providers who are contracted with us. And then we also have a county commissioner council. And this has been kind of interesting. We do have participation from commissioners from each of the three counties that we serve. It is a dotted line, a little bit different than the other councils. And that is because it's about sharing information. They were very concerned about any associated liabilities sitting on the board, that sort of thing. But are very much participating in sharing information and providing input to the CCO. As a matter of fact, we had a commissioner ask us about our next meeting, and so that focus and that council has functioned very well. This is the structure of our governance.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Close, I have to get used to saying that.
On the liability issue, will you just expand on that, what their concerns were?
I think the concerns were that as a county commissioner sitting on the board of a CCO, that there might be, as a board member, you have fiduciary responsibilities, that there might be liability concerns that they might bring back to the county level. And so they chose to participate in a more advisory fashion, and that seemed to satisfy. We do have on the board and as I'm talking about here, some of the directors of the county mental health agencies, who, of course, are employees of the county.
So this would be lawsuits that might be filed by people that were served. Is that what you're saying?
Served or denied services for whatever reason, or desiring services that weren't within the benefit structure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. is the governance structure. The structure and the intent of it is to make sure that all major stakeholders have a seat at the table and a voice of input of governance. We are a All Care Health Plan is owned by 78 providers in Josephine County. So we are an IPA in our origins. And we do have on our governance board 11 of our owner shareholder providers. And then we have 10 directors who come from the community stakeholder population. As I mentioned earlier, we have three community advisory councils, one for each county that we serve. And that was a decision made by the stakeholders. Instead of having a combined or conglomerate community advisory council to deal with the community health assessment and community health improvement plan, it was felt that each of our communities had some unique needs, and we wanted to hear those and address those separately. So we have three councils, and each council has a seat on the governing board. Each chair of those councils have that seat on the governing board. And then our clinical advisory panel is six providers or other representatives, the mental health representatives from the County Mental Health Authority, hospital representatives, dental representatives. We did put a dental representative on our board in anticipation of dental integration. And then other general provider representatives, alcohol and drug. And then we have one public member at large.
And is that public member also on the community advisory committee?
Actually, the public member at this point is an actuary, and no, he is not. He's truly just an at-large member.
And you have about 3 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. This is a little bit of a profile of our community advisory council, 7 to 11 members, one seat on the governing board, and then their key areas of focus. And right now, each of those councils have met. Each of them have 51% Oregon Health Plan enrollee participation, and they are focusing on the community needs assessment. We are doing a detailed analysis in the Rogue Valley of what is available, what we need to do, what each of the organizations are required to present in terms of community health needs assessments, and then putting one together for the CCO. Been very, very excited about these community advisory councils. They've been very engaged, and they're ready to go to work, and I think that this is a critical point of input for the consumer. Our clinical advisory panel has not met yet. The way we have a lot of players who have duplicate responsibilities with duplicate CCOs maybe in that service area, so we hope to launch the clinical advisory panel in the early part of next year, and we see the representation that we have there across all provider levels and up to 20 members. So we count on that panel being a very critical piece of input for our governing board as well. Just want to touch a little bit on some of the things that are happening within the CCO in terms of integration of care. We do have an interdisciplinary team formed. They meet three times a week, reviewing ER, inpatient, and skilled nursing services. This has proved to be very, very beneficial. We do have a clinical pharmacist on that committee, and we've really started to make some inroads in terms of integration, place of service, transitions of care. We also actively engage in case management and do a health risk assessment on all enrollees within the first 90 days of enrollment. And from that health risk assessment can then highlight those who may have more complex needs and address those with case management immediately.
And how many do you have?
We have 24,000 enrollees. We do care plan development for those with more complex diseases, and then, of course, transitions of care management when they transition from the ER home, hospital, inpatient home to skilled nursing. That's where a lot care can be dropped or impaired, and so we focus heavily on transitions of care. I did want to mention that All Care has 30 patient-centered primary care offices certified. We have about 86% of our practices in Josephine County are certified as PCPCH. We're very, very proud of that. About 50%, I think Dr. Goldberg mentioned about 50% of our members are being seen in the patient-centered primary care home. And it is our goal to move that to 100%. We support some of our private small practices with training modules and consultant support support to assist them to achieve that certification, and we have a shared resource center available to them. We have for the last year been focusing on various outcomes metrics prior to the definition of the final metrics. We have had a focus on the lower level ER visits for the last year, and we have seen significant reductions in those level one and two visits, which probably belong in a primary care office. And then we've also generated a performance a provider performance data report, and we distribute that to our providers in a de-identified fashion, and it compares them against their peers, measures things like preventative care, focus on preventative care, primary care visits, emergency room visits, so they can really see how they're doing in comparison with their peers, and it has a risk score that gives them some idea of the level of severity and complexity of their patients. Again, information and data to help them make decisions.
You need to sum up.
Okay. Challenges that we face moving forward, the fee-for-service transition is proving challenging, but we've been migrating that relatively well. We have some reticence on the part of some providers to move to a true risk payment methodology, and we continue to hold discussions about that. We've learned there are significant differences in the documentation required for mental health processes, and that is impacting integration and impacting care. And so that presents a challenge for us. How are we going to encounter flexible service? What programs are going to be expanded into the global budget? Non-emergent medical transportation upcoming in July, very critical for our rural service area. Looking forward to definition around that program. Different organizational cultures, very, very prevalent, blending those together. It all takes time. We have achieved some successes thus far. We have our infrastructure in place, and we are moving forward with our transformation plan, our performance improvement projects. So actually, the real work is just beginning, but we're very, very excited about what we've done thus far, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share that with you today.
That's great. It is exciting to see what a real CCO is doing. I mean, we're at the 36,000-foot level, and just keep us apprised.
We will. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. All right, next presentation on health insurance in Oregon, Leanne Gassaway from the American Health Insurance Plan.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. While she's getting that up, I'm going to go to try to save as much time as we can and move quickly. You have a very large slide presentation in front of you. I'm not going to go through 27 slides. But I did want to highlight four things for you today, which I think are important as we move forward in the important work of healthcare reform. The first set of slides that you have in front of you, through about slide six, you will see that the Oregon healthcare marketplace is actually extremely competitive, more efficient than its other neighbors, if you will, and is performing in a with lower costs than the majority of the nation. And I think that says well that there's things going on here in Oregon that have been in place for a number of years that need to be learned from in the rest of the nation. So that's kind of just a premise to start with. Now, does that mean that it's perfect? Absolutely not. And that gets kind of to my second point, which are healthcare costs are still paramount, and they are still going up. So even though in Oregon we've done a good job of keeping those costs lower than other places in the nation, they're still going up, and that is still putting tremendous pressure on families and businesses here in the state. So I want to draw your attention to slide seven, if you will. Oops. Okay. Slide 7 kind of outlines primary cost drivers that are going on, and this is where we have been laser-focused as an industry, and we will continue as we move through healthcare reform implementation, because for all the good things that the Affordable Care Act can do in expanding access to care, it does not necessarily address affordability of care, and that's where we are going to be laser-focused. So the next set of slides that you have in front of you are really about what is driving costs, and there are a set of underlying cost drivers that are detailed out in a set of slides in front of you. Those have to deal with uncompensated care. Those have to deal with underfunding from public programs. Those have to deal with unit cost, the actual cost of the widget that we use in healthcare, whether that be people, technology, drugs, new services, new technologies. All of that is going up, and that unit cost is one driver. And then on top of that, we have increased utilization because of our aging population. And so you kind of put those two factors together, and they move forward very quickly. So those are just kind of a quick overview of what is driving healthcare costs. But I want to stress that there are additional costs that are coming, which is where I'm going to spend the majority of my comments today. Because of healthcare reform, there's a lot of things going on, and there's going to be upward pressure, and I think we heard this from Rocky this morning, that there's a lot of upward pressure that is coming because of healthcare reform. And this slide, I want to highlight what those upward pressures are. So there are certain things in the Affordable Care Act that are downward, that are pushing down that cost premium bar, if you will. But I want to highlight a couple of things. One, those subsidies are only available to a subset of the population, primarily those that are 400% of federal poverty level or lower, and they are only available in the individual market. So they are not available in the small employer or large employer market. But we do have a set of things that are pushing that premium cost up. So we have the essential benefit changes that are coming. You heard Lou and the group talk about that this morning. So there are things that are going to be added to the benefit package that people have not traditionally had covered, and those are going to be covered, and with those come added costs. The age rating compression, I'm actually going to talk about that in far more detail in a moment. We have some modest incentives to purchase coverage. I think most of us recognize that the penalties for failure to carry coverage continuously are probably inadequate, at least in their initial years. They do grow over the first 3 years, but those it's going to be a very careful balance of how do we get people into the system and keep them continuously covered. That's going to be the challenge we all need to face. We have the underlying pressures of rising healthcare costs, which I just talked about. We have the ACA premium tax, the health insurance tax, which I'm also going to talk about in more detail. We also have the 1% Oregon premium tax, which is sunsetting next year, and we think that that is a good thing to relieve the premium from having that additional obligation. You have OMIP assessments and exchange assessments as well that are being added to the premium dollars as we implement health care reform. One thing that I will stress, you can just flow through all those, is that in Oregon, we have set up a system to review rates and premiums to ensure value for consumers. And this rate review process is actually probably one of the most robust rate review systems in the nation. This slide, which is slide 15 in your handouts there, kind of goes through, and a lot of folks may not understand how comprehensive it is, where a rate filing is done and it's opened up for public comment, like a rule, it's posted on the OID's website. They take public comment, they hold a public hearing, it is now webcast so that folks don't even have to travel in, they can actually offer comments and listen to the dialogue through a webcast system. And then the OID has a very exhaustive list of items that they look at that are listed on this slide for you, everything from trend and assumptions made and what's going on in enrollment, what's going on in benefit and product design, what's going on cost sharing. And all of that is reflected in those rate filings. So I just wanted to highlight that because I think we somehow think that this is an unregulated kind of territory of the Wild West, and it really is not. We are, in Oregon especially, we are doing an incredibly comprehensive group of reviewing those premium rates and letting the OID really get in deep. And not only that, but they have about $900,000 in grant money that they have available to them to pay consumer representatives to look at these rate filings as well and to offer public comments on those and ask questions. So I just wanted to highlight that because I think that that is a check and balance that has been put in place here in Oregon to help with that that process. The last thing I want to quickly go through is what is ahead of us with health reform. which is on slide 17. So there are a number of changes coming. You heard about many of these this morning in the Joint Committee. But just to give you a glimpse, we have the individual responsibility requirement coming on January 1, 2014. We need to figure out how to incent continuous enrollment. We have the large employer responsibility requirement, which is a requirement on large employers to offer coverage or pay an assessment to help their employees get that coverage through the private market. Guaranteed issue and no pre-existing conditions, rating requirements, which I'm going to talk about more at length, the essential benefit mandates, which we talked about this morning, changes to the actual product. Annual limits have been removed. Risk adjustment is coming. The health insurance tax is coming. Medicaid expansion is coming. And we still need to figure out what to do with the state's high-risk pool. Back in July, Wakely did a report here for the state of Oregon that started to highlight some of how these different changes would impact the marketplace. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of things in this report because it's a really important document that goes through a very kind of technical analysis of how this is going to affect cost and premium and consumption. And so one thing that I'd like is there are certain items that were considered. There were certain items that were not considered. Go ahead one more. Let me do that one more. Oh, I hate it when it does that. Just go to the next slide. So slide 20 talks about two particular elements that I'd like to call to your attention. One is the essential health benefits buy-up, if you will. And it's not like that's an optional buy-up. This is an increase in benefits that's coming because of those 10 categories of coverage that are required under the ACA. And as we heard this morning, the essential health benefits package that was selected by the state covers all the state mandates, but there's added things to that package that have to now be also put on in there that were not there. That's going to result in about a 6% increase in premiums just to add those extra benefits. Secondly is the age rating compression, and this is extremely important as we move, especially for younger workers. So the age rating compression, today it's about 5-1 in the state, where the oldest enrollee pays about 5 times more than the very youngest enrollee. And a lot of that has to do with utilization and how much more we use healthcare when we're older than when we're younger. And so what this is doing is compressing that to a 3-1 age ban under the ACA. And what this does is disproportionately has a huge impact on workers under the age of 45. And as you can see in the Wakely data, about 58% of enrollees will have an increase in premiums of various amounts. And the rest may either see flat or a small reduction, but the reductions is extremely small compared to the increases that are happening. And this is the group primarily that is the largest amount of uninsured in our state. They are the young immortals, as we like to call them. And so primarily, this is a group that has a higher rate of uninsured, and now we're going to increase their premiums in a disproportionate way. So we at AHIP, as well with our member companies, as well as many of the insurance commissioners around the state and legislative delegations, are asking Congress and the administration, the Obama administration, to reconsider this particular provision, either phase it in, hold it steady at 5-1 for a number of years, and move it later, just to stop this amount of disruption to this particular segment of the population that's inadvertently impacted by that. The next graphic gives you kind of a...
But I have a question.
Yes.
Here. I mean, obviously, and I shouldn't compare it to the auto industry, but, you know, when we mandated that and the majority of people don't have accidents, and we have to look at a sustainable system. So when you question some of the things that we are doing here, it'd be nice to be able to come up with another solution. I like your phase-in, you know, ideas on the youth, those under 45, which I consider all youth. but we have a real sustainability problem in this nation, and so and in the state. So I know this is an issue, but I think we all have to keep that in mind.
Chairman Sanderson, you're absolutely right. This is one of many issues that we need to address. This one in particular, we feel we have put a potential, at least not a Band-Aid, if you will, but a little bit of a pen situation where if we could just hold it for a period of time to allow the other changes to come in and make that effect and then have this effect come later, that would be a solution we think could at least reduce the disruption to this particular age cohort. I will say in Oregon, we have actually a little experience in this area where if you recall several years ago when in small group reform where we took the 2 to 25s and we merged them with the 26 to 50s. And when we did that, there was usually an increase in premiums that happened in the 26 to 50 groups because they were not kind of getting all the other rating restrictions that were applicable to the 2 to 25. So when we did that, the 2 to 25s kind of saw a flat or a small decrease. The 26 to 50s saw an increase, and we phased that in here in Oregon. And I think that that is something that we realized that initially when it passed, there was not a phase-in, and it was like, boom, let's make it happen. And then once we realized the impact there was going to be on a large segment of those bigger small employers, we went to a phase-in approach. I think what we've realized now is when we look at the data, the same type of idea makes sense to either hold it for a couple of years while the other changes come through and then implement this later on. And so we are working with Congress and the administration on that. Right. And if we have your support, that would be fantastic. This graphic just...
Your shields?
I can wait till the end of your presentation.
Okay. Thank you. This graphic kind of just gives you a clear example of what that age rating will do. The next thing I want to highlight is the health insurance tax. The health insurance tax is almost $102 billion tax over the course of 10 years. That was one of the primary financing mechanisms for the ACA. As you can see from this graphic, it's bigger than any of the other taxes that are being levied on other elements of the healthcare system. And it really calls into question if it's wise to tax healthcare to pay for healthcare. We're taxing the very thing we're trying to make more affordable. But this actually, AHIP has commissioned Oliver Wyman to do this study, which actually looked at every single state's actual impact. And this is Oregon's impact right here on this slide. And as you can see, using market share data at the individual, small group, and large group data sets that were available, this tax will increase on individuals purchasing their own coverage by about $2,000 over that 10-year period. For a family, you're looking at a little bit over almost $4,700 over that 10-year period a family will have to pay as their part of this tax. Employers will also have to pay an increased amount of almost $3,000 per employee for over that 10-year period for every employee to pay this tax. And for family coverage, if they're offering that, $6,886 per family unit working for a small employer. Large employers also have to pay this tax, and those numbers are up there as well for individual and family coverage. So one thing I do want to highlight as we move in the state is Medicaid is not exempt. So Medicaid managed care plans also have to pay this tax. And so the state will, and the CCOs that are now absorbing that Medicaid managed care responsibility will have to pay about $1,727 per individual, per Medicaid beneficiary over the course of this 10 years to pay their part of this health insurance tax. And again, we don't understand why you're taxing the item that you're trying to make more affordable and that you're putting federal subsidies back into the states to pay for. And so this is one of our number one our priorities as well at the federal level is to repeal this tax. It will lower health care costs. It will remove this tax from the consumer who has to pay it, and it will help us to get serious about affordability. Just to kind of wrap up, I'll end with slide 24, which is, again, from the Wakely report here done in Oregon, which showed overall premium impact by the ACA as it's written today will result in about an average rate impact of 38%. And so this comes from Wakely data that was done for the state of Oregon. It was not done for AHIP. But I wanted to highlight that because this is where we're going to be focused. And why we're doing this today is to call on the legislature to let us implement over the course of this next couple of years. As you heard this morning, there's a lot going on. And we do ask really that we look to pause on further grand scale kinds of implementation. Yeah, tweaks will need to be done around the edges, but we have a lot of work that's going on. All of it's very good. A lot of it's innovative, and we need to be able to let that start to take hold and do its thing. So with that, I'll close.
Thank you. Oh, this is really valuable information. I really appreciate the extensiveness and the
Yeah, there's a lot more in there.
Yeah, there is a lot in here. So thank you very, very much.
All right.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased that the industry is very happy with the rate review processes we've put in place over the last couple of years. One question that I have for you, and I appreciate you coming to speak to my committee. She was very gracious with her time to come speak to the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee in the past. You hear a lot that Oregon has one of the most competitive marketplaces. In fact, just recently it was determined that it was the most competitive. You know, we've got a state with, you know, significant unemployment, not a whole lot of big employers. Why do you think it is that Oregon is the most competitive state in the nation?
Chairwoman Moss-Anderson, Senator Shields. I think one is we have strong commitments. I think there's some very strong commitments from health plans who have been in the Oregon market for some time, and that they see it as a state that they want to do business in. It's very difficult for a state to enter a new state, or it's difficult for a company to just enter a new state wholeheartedly. Like, I'm just going to start selling. And so I think that there, because of the climate that's been in place for 20 years ago to now, I think that it's been a place where insurers have been able to do good work. And so I think that we want to continue that. And I know that my member companies want to stay in the state of Oregon. Now, to the extent that that becomes more difficult, that is not an easy decision for them to make. There's a lot of uncertainty in the environment right now, and I think that every company is going to have to go through the difficult decision of, do they go into the exchange or not? Do they stay in the individual market or not? Do they expand in small group or not? Many, and I didn't even talk about the large group market. There's actually even more carriers that are in the large group market that are in small and individual. We have about 7 carriers here in Oregon that are heavily invested in the individual and small group market. And so there's no kind of one big gorilla on the ground. It's an extremely competitive environment. And I see that in my own member companies, because when I'm trying to herd them, you know, along in an issue, they're competitors. And they, you know, they want to have those customers. And so I think that, you know, for whatever reason, Oregon has been a place where we have been blessed with a competitive environment.
All right. Unfortunately, we don't have more time to, because there's a lot of info in here. But
thank
you very, very much. With that, we'll have an update from the autism group. Let's limit it to 5 minutes or less. Paul Trudell. Paul, are you there? Do you want to unmute?
Let's limit it to 5 minutes or less.
Who's listening?
Paul, are you there? Do you want to unmute?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks.
Okay, and then Shane Jackson. So who's going to start?
We'll start with Toby Rates, if you don't mind.
And we really do need to
be very brief.
Yeah, be very brief.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and Senators. I'm Toby Rates. I reside in outer southeast Portland, and I'm here as the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon. We are the largest autism group in Oregon and the only one that operates statewide. Our mission is to empower individuals on the spectrum to improve the quality of their lives through support and information. Over 5,600 people across Oregon access ASO as a resource and participate in our activities. This legislation would clarify and reinforce existing law to require that people on the autism spectrum have insurance coverage for autism therapies. These medically necessary, evidence-based therapies help autistic individuals live more functional and productive lives and reduce their dependence on government supports. Providing intensive therapies, particularly for young children, reduces the cost to the educational system by reducing the need for special ed services, and in the long run reduces the need for governmental supports for adults. Providing the right therapies at the right time can be the difference between an adult who's earning a paycheck and one who's drawing government support. I wanted to say that we appreciate the leadership of Senator Bates and Senator Haas in bringing together all the stakeholders to try and reach consensus on this issue. We've made enormous progress, and we have another legislative workgroup session scheduled for January. Additionally, we're very pleased that just last month, Kaiser Permanente voluntarily started covering autism therapies without age limits, dollar limits, or visit limits, and without an increase in premiums. We applaud their actions, and we'd love to see other health insurers in Oregon following suit. The autism community has waited years for our children's needs to be addressed by the medical community. Last year when I testified on this issue, 29 other states provided insurance coverage for autism treatments. The number's now up to 32. It's past time that Oregon joined the fight to give autistic individuals the chance to achieve their potential of leading meaningful, productive lives. Thank you for your time.
I'm Shane Jackson, registered lobbyist for the Autism Society of Oregon. Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and the committee for this opportunity to deliver this progress report on crafting an autism insurance reform bill. I'm pleased to say that measurable progress has been made towards guaranteeing that the medical needs of the people on the autism spectrum are met in a timely manner. The process that has brought us to this point has been the height of legitimacy. From the first bill introduced in 2011 session to the placeholder bills we have now in LC, we have been involved in a continuous dialogue that has included any and all stakeholders. We have been extremely fortunate and have been working with Senator Mark Hass and Senator Dr. Alan Bates. Under their guidance, the work group that they assembled has point by point addressed concerns, brought compromises that we all have agreed to. We are also privileged to be crafting this bill with the input of such people as Tom Holt of Regents, Dr. David Pass, medical doctor, Jenny Fisher, a board-certified behavior analyst, Toby Rates of the ASO, Paul Trudell, and we currently stand very close to presenting the finalized bill after our January 10th meeting. I'm sure we will have one. When this bill passes, it will stand out as the premier autism insurance reform bill in the country. Not only will it guarantee the delivery of evidence-based treatments like applied behavior and assessment, but it will also establish the nation's first licensing and registry authority for the care providers, a new level of quality and treatment. In essence, this bill has been always about getting the right treatment to the right people at the right time. The treatments have been proven. They are not experimental or investigative. We have the ability to diagnose and to check that diagnosis in a reasonable time. We can develop and deliver a treatment plan that is effective and cost-effective. Now we need to guarantee that those who need treatment get what they deserve. I look forward to coming back in February with a bill that accomplishes just that. Paul?
Thank you. And Paul, your turn.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Paul Trudell. I live in Portland, Oregon. I am currently testifying by phone from Baltimore, Maryland, where my son is undergoing intensive autism treatment for autism-related feeding disorder at Johns Hopkins. Let me just briefly review the draft framework that we have discussed. Just bear in mind, this is my own summary. It doesn't represent a formal consensus statement from the full group. So key points, first in terms of scope, this would apply to all plans subject to state regulations. That doesn't really include commercial insurance plans. It would also include PEB, OEB, Healthy Kids, and the Oregon Health Plan. In terms of treatment, whereas previous bills provided a very comprehensive and broad scope of treatment, this particular bill would be limited solely to applied behavior analysis, but would leave existing insurance mandates in ORS 743A168 and 190 in place. For coverage of ABA therapy specifically, it would allow an insurer to require an insurer to provide ABA so long as there was a diagnosis confirmed by a certified diagnosis center, and it would empower the Oregon Health Authority to certify centers of programs that can confirm autism diagnosis. For providers, the bill will create a behavior analyst licensing board under the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. This permanent board will establish credentialing requirements for behavior analysts, assistant behavior analysts, and behavior analysis technicians. It will continue to allow reimbursement for ABA services provided by other licensed healthcare professionals so long as the services performed are in the licensed healthcare professional scope of practice. Behavior analyst technicians will be certified or registered by the board but not licensed. The board will set requirements for those providers by administrative rule, and they would work under the direction of a licensed behavior analyst or other licensed provider who would be responsible for their qualifications and training. The bill has a couple of other provisions. It would establish a framework by which children ages 0 to 8 who have a certified autism diagnosis and are seeking up to 25 hours of ABA therapy per week would be covered without pre-authorization. Older patients over age 8 and those who need more than 25 hours of ABA therapy per week would still be covered, but may be subject to pre-authorization. Insurers would not be permitted to establish a contractual age or visit limit beyond which patients could be denied coverage without regard to medical necessity. Finally, Oregon schools will be required to provide, to continue to provide special education services to students with autism, and would not be permitted to use this bill as an opportunity to reduce services. I have submitted some written documents to the committee, which I hope can be published, which identify, summarize that in writing and provide some additional details about other developments. We also have a couple of other related legislative concepts, which I believe probably best if we distribute those to the committee in writing. Do you have any questions?
No, we don't really have time for questions, but thank you, Paul. We just wanted to get, this on the record and for other stakeholders to hear what the group has been doing. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'd like to open work session. Do I have to open work session? Yeah, I'd like to open work session for introduction of committee legislative concepts.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
You're supposed to say something about this. This isn't a pro or con on any of these things. It's just getting them introduced, but I will say that for you.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 211 dated 5/23/12, LC 982 dated 10/4/12, LC 1275 dated 10/8/12, LC 1276 dated 12/10/12, LC 1312 dated 10/10/12, LC 1364 dated 10/11/12, LC 1518 dated 11/16/12, LC 2109 dated 12/6/12, LC 2219 dated 11/19/12, LC 2610 dated 11/1/12, LC 1409 dated 10/5/12, and LC 1506 dated 10/5/12.
All right, Senator Cruz has moved those following LCs, LC 211, 982, 1275, 1276, 1312, 1364, 1518, 2109, 2219, 2610, 1409, and 1506. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Close.
Thank you, Chairman Sanderson. I don't have any problem with accepting these LCs. However, I just want to put on the record that under the immunization issue, I've read the drafts. I noticed that parents are missing from various boards, and that
982.
The parental
is that side, LC 982?
Excuse me, 982-1, and then 1518 is the board. I just want to put on the record that I hope that you, when these reach committee, that you will entertain amendments to try to at least let parents give some sort of input here.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Well noted. All right. Any other discussion? If not, the measure is, there's no opposition? If so, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And since there's nothing further on the agenda, thank you, and we'll see you in January. Happy holidays, everyone, and we're adjourned.